I'm going to summarize the four colliders that we've been talking about, and so doing, I've borrowed heavily from review talks by Frank Zimmerman, G. Gao, and Phil Burrows for Click. There's been a talk already on CPC last week, and Alan gave a nice review of these accelerators actually yesterday. But since there are people coming in and out, I'll go through all the accelerators anyway. I'll start with the FCC. And the goal of the current study is a CDR and a cost review for the European study in 2018. And the FCC is first a PP collider of ordered 100 TeV center mass energy. This means 16 Tesla field in a 100 kilometer tunnel, and utilizing infrastructure in the Geneva area. And then also there's an option for an E plus E minus collider, FCCE, as an intermediate step before the PP collider, and also electron proton or electron hadron option as well. Of course, I'll be talking about the FCCEE. So again, the scope of this study is the 100 TeV proton-proton collider, also the E plus E minus collider, and they're also including HE-LHC as part of this study as well. The idea being to hopefully benefit from all the work that's been done here and revisit again the possibility of higher energy PP machine in the LHC tunnel. So the various the key technologies being pushed, the magnets and superconducting RF, as I said, is linked to the CERN complex as well. So for the Alan went through this yesterday, the physics program of FCCE, TERRA-Z study of a high precision measurement of the Z properties. A W pair production for a high precision, 160 GeV for high precision measurement of the W mass, and then a very large, a true Higgs factory at 120 GeV, and also at 175 GeV, an extension of the Higgs studies. We study WW fusion of Higgs, and the measurement of the TT bar threshold. Beam energies range from basically the Z pole to the above the TT bar threshold, and then there was also a mention of the direct S channel production of the Higgs at 125 GeV with monochromatization, and some polarization up to 80 GeV for precise beam energy calibration. But otherwise, polarization is not part of this. So here these are the parameters. These are the most recent parameters with the most recent design, showing the luminosities at the Z, the W, and the Z Higgs production and TT bar. Boundary condition is that the synchrotron power is 100 is 100 megawatts. And for comparison, the LEP2 numbers are shown here. So there's been a recent breakthrough in the design whereby some conditions have been satisfied, namely that the FCCE ring is compatible with the Hadron Collider ring, and it has, in this case, the baseline design has two IPs. Also, there's this has been done in such a way that the this has been done in such a way that the dynamic aperture and acceptance requirements have been fulfilled at all the different working points. And this is shown in this slide here. They also point out that a lot has been gained and will be gained from the operation of Super Keck B. Top-off injection, high current, and the off momentum acceptance. It's kind of a nice testing ground to prove the points of to prove the design of FCCEE. So there's a solid baseline with a functioning optics with space for improvement at lower energies. The current, in Frank's presentation, he didn't mention a third or fourth IP, but that's also in the hopes of some of the advocates. So let me move on then to the CPC. The CPC is the pre-CDR has a circumference of about 50 kilometers. It includes and as basically a single ring plus and minus collider, which is supposed to be compatible with a future hadron collider as well in the same tunnel shown here. And then there's a booster ring. There's actually a booster ring for the FCCEE as well, but I didn't mention it. So there actually in both designs there are, in this design there are two E plus E minus rings, and in the FCCEE there are three rings. These are the design goals for CPC, 2 × 10^34 at the and for ZH production, and greater than 10^34 at the Z pool. And the goal is to satisfy both of these with the same layout and hardware. Furthermore, the interaction or interrelations with the proton collider in the same tunnel is that the CPC would be built, and after a certain number of years, one would start to build the proton collider in the same tunnel. In the machine design, these could be operated at the same time in principle, but I don't know. The tunnel length is determined by the CPC and the proton collider jointly. So in the with a single ring, you have to concern yourself with parasitic collisions, and this is handled in the pre-CDR with a pretzel scheme. So you have these pair of electrostatic separators in each arc, and at other points. This is the parameter set for the single ring, showing the luminosity of 2 × 10^34 at 240 GeV, and 1 × 10^34 at the Z. But there's also the main problems left over from the pre-CDR. The pretzel scheme is difficult to design and operate. It requires a high amount of power. The booster with a very low magnetic field and small dynamic aperture, very low luminosity for the Z with a single ring, a small dynamic aperture, 2% energy spread for the collider. So there are other designs being considered. And that's shown here, where there's two approaches being taken as they move toward the CDR. One is this to continue to work on the single ring pretzel scheme, and the other is to go for a partial double ring design, where it's double near the IP, and other developments as well. What's that? Well, I would 10^34 would be low luminosity. Right. So it's yeah, that, but that, yeah, so it's all relative, but yeah. Oh no, it is. I'll show a design at a larger circumference.
Now they're talking
70 is the baseline. Well, sorry, say again. And if there's a favorable reaction, you propose a bigger ring. Let's see. However, but I wonder, but it looks, but they haven't, but my, sorry. My impression is though, they have not given up yet on this pretzel scheme. It's still being worked on. Okay, so this is the partial double ring, but the parasitic collisions are handled with a switch to a double ring a few kilometers from the IP. And so it avoids this complication of the pretzel orbit, accommodates more bunches at the lower energies, and reduces the AC power. I believe this came out of, I think this is another one of Frank Zimmerman's contributions originally. So these are the parameter sets for the partial double ring with the initial idea of 50 kilometers. And then it has a low power option with the same luminosity. And then the higher power option with a slightly higher luminosity, and now you have instead of 1 times 1034, you have 1034 at the lower energies. And then so here's the 100 kilometer partial double ring design. So now we're up to at the ZH, we're up to 5 times 1034 with the higher power and 3 times 10 to the 34 with low power option. And now we're getting up to also very high luminosities at the Z. Well, of course, at 100 kilometers now you're approaching the FCCE. And in addition, they're still exploring options, not just the partial double ring, but the full double ring as well, just like FCCE, and that's also being investigated as well. So I'd, yeah. It's interesting to go through the conclude. This is an April workshop at CPC. Jigao had these conclusions at the end of this talk, from which I got all of these transparencies. So the accelerator design goes well toward the CDR with the required physics goals. They've done parameter scans of both CPC and the SPPC, the proton collider, with different energies, circumferences, and schemes. The partial double ring lattice has been completed, and the dynamic aperture optimization has started. The pretzel scheme work is still going on. Local double ring superconducting RF system design has been completed, and then there are other details here as well. And the international collaboration started and will continue, and so forth. Let me switch now to E plus E minus colliders, and I'll start with CLIC. So CLIC is an X-band linear collider powered by a second drive beam with a center mass energy range, design of a center mass energy range of 350 GV to 3000 GV. Its length is 13 kilometers at 500 G, 48 at 3 TV, and it's actually 11 kilometers at 350 or 380. So the RF, the X-band RF power is produced with a drive beam, which is decelerated, and the RF is extracted. At 3 TV, there are two drive beam accelerators. The initial design here showed pre-damping rings in addition to damping rings for both the electrons and the positrons, although that's now has been changed a little bit, I'll show in a second. So the CLIC physics goals, well, the context is a physics scenario whereby there are lots of particles to be studied beyond beyond a few hundred GeV. Although even if there's not, there's still the Nudu-Higgs production of that can be used for more precise Higgs boson studies, and also the Higgs self-coupling, as we heard yesterday, can be measured to roughly 10% at a click. But the main, this is, for example, something which becomes extremely attractive if suddenly there's a lot of new particles being discovered by LHC. A CDR was written a few years ago, both for the accelerator and for physics and detectors. This shows a layout of the accelerator in the near CERN, with the footprint for 500 GeV, 1.5 TeV, and 3 TeV. Basically, it's 100 megavolts per meter, and you just simply extend the number of cavities to increase the energy. The CDR was done before the Higgs was discovered. It was optimized for 3 TeV and not for lower energies. It had a first look at the power requirements, some industrial costing, but the overall cost was not optimized for the study. The X-band demonstrations were limited by the test capacity around the world. A lot more has been done since then. There was also a staging study done where it was assumed that you start at 500 GeV and accumulate this kind of luminosity, then install more beamline and run at 1.5 TeV, and then after 20 years from the start, you would run at 3 TeV. These are the parameters of those three stages: 500 GeV, 1.5, and 3 TeV. Again, the accelerating constant is just constant at 100 megavolts per meter, and the luminosities are shown here for 500 and 1.5 and 3 TeV. The power consumption is shown in these columns here, and so the power consumption for the 3 TeV design is one that, because it's above 500 megawatts, it might raise some eyebrows, but just to put in context, the kind of the boundary condition for the FCC HH is 500 megawatts, and this is an advertised power for the FCCE at the TT bar region, and also currently the only estimate made so far for CPC is 500 megawatts. So it's not completely out of the picture with respect to the other future clusters that are being considered. More recently, there's been a rebaselining for 380 GeV and 3 TeV. So basically, there's been a 380 GeV design and some small changes to the 3 TeV design. This 380 GeV design is shown here. You only need one, first of all, there's only 11 kilometers required. The drive beam, there's only one drive beam accelerator needed. The pre-damping ring for the electron has been removed, although that's not just for the 300, the TT bar area, that's also at 3 TV. It's thought now to no longer be needed. So the 3 TV, there's been some changes. This damping ring has been removed, 50 kilometers instead of 48 kilometers, and 25 sectors instead of 24. So some relatively small changes. On purpose put these right together so you can see the changes. It's an extra dry beam accelerator, and more cavities to extract the RF, and otherwise, that's it. This turnaround has to be moved down. the goal is 100 megavolts per meter with this green line for the breakdown rate shown here. And this shows just the current progress. There's some that that do pass the that are do meet the spec for the breakdown rate and the gradient, but some that don't meet, some that make the gradient but not the breakdown rate. This just shows that there's work that continues in this, and there's progress being made. So Phil Burrows summarized this in the January of this year. Aim to provide optimized stage approach up to 3 TV with cost and power not excessive compared to LHC. Good progress on X-band technology. There's better availability of power sources and increased understanding of the structure design parameters. Also good progress on performance verification, drive beam, beam emittance conservation at a facility at SLAC, and final focus studies at KEK. Technical developments and key parts are well underway with increasing involvement with industry. So now moving on to the ILC. The ILC is a superconducting RF E plus minus linear collider. The baseline design has a energy range from 250 to 500 GV with an energy upgrade option up to 1 TV. It's 30 kilometers in length for the 500 GV option and 50 kilometers length up to 1 TV, although at the site there's even more room available than that, up to 60 kilometers or so. So there's there are two in the baseline design, there are two damping rings about 3 kilometers in circumference. The positrons are produced by colliding electrons with a sending electrons through an undulator that produce photons that then collide with a source that then provides the with the target that then provides the source of positrons that are polarized. In addition to the main LINAC here, you have return lines of equal length going from the damping ring complex to the end of the accelerators. And there's an IR region with a push-pull system for two different detectors. And these are the parameters from the TDR published in 2013. It has baseline designs at 250, 350, and 500 GeV. And then it has a luminosity upgrade design, which for this TDR was only shown at 500 GeV, but it's been applied since then to 250 and 350. And then energy upgrade parameters are shown here as well. So there are two types of upgrades. One is a luminosity upgrade, where you install extra klystrons and modulators so that you can double the number of bunches. And that is envisioned to take place about 8 years after the baseline running starts. And then an energy upgrade involves increasing the accelerating gradient and lengthening the LINAC in both, really. And that's because of the extra cost. This is relatively inexpensive. This is quite expensive, and so it's currently not envisioned to take place until after 20 years of running it at 500 GeV and 250 GeV. Not included in that TDR, but in the months following, there was the double number of bunches were applied then to 250 GeV. And then on top of that, it was recognized that given this power of only 129 megawatts, it was really not a problem to switch to 10 hertz so long as you can produce enough positrons with the 125 GeV electrons. And that's thought to be possible with a longer undulator that should be ready by the time that you'd want to go to the luminosity upgrade, or if not sooner. And then also this is the same power as the has the 500 GeV. It's the 500 GeV luminosity upgrade. Okay, so progress on the ILC since the TDR. In 2015, a progress report was produced. It included things like, since then, the preferred site in Japan was identified. And a lot of work has been on that, the geological survey, and then accelerated hardware design and development updates, integration and test facilities, the scale of a hub laboratory. A lot of work done since the since the TDR published in this progress report shown here. The site chosen, there was a site in the south, in the southwest, and then a site here in the, above north of Sendai. And this was the one that was chosen. As I said, it's about roughly 50 kilometers or up to 60 kilometers in length. Some of the highlights, the technical highlights in the year since the TDR. Work goes on for the European XFEL. It has a smaller gradient requirement than the ILC, but still is a very nice test bed. It's exceeded 90% of 800 cavity productions and 65% of the 100 cryo module assembly and tests. And then the at the for the higher gradient research at Fermilab, gradients of greater than 1.5 megavolts per meter were achieved, but the ILC spec. Then a 12 cavity string under cold test at KEK. Also at KEK, the final focus test achieved a 44 nanometer beam spot, which is closing in on the goal of 37 nanometers. Recall that these, of course, takes place at lower energies, so the spot sizes will not be the same, but the demagnification corresponds to the nanometer beams of ILC. Then there's geological survey and boring at the chosen site, and things like a tunnel optimization tool being developed and along with CERN and KEK. Then there have been some design changes. They call it the accelerated design and integration. A common L-star for both the it was shrunk a little bit, so they have a common L-star for both ILD and SID. Vertical access at the detector hall instead of a sloping tunnel. And then the extension of the main LINAC tunnel length for optimizing E plus minus collision timing, and that actually also played a role in gave the possibility to increase this San Marcos energy from 500 to 550 GeV. This just gives you an example of just a flavor of what's going on in Japan. The boring tests that determine the geology in the IP area. And other studies of the tunnel, studies for alignment, access caverns, and optimization of the position of these areas with respect to the surface, subsurface, and so forth. Just to give you a flavor of the kind of activity that's taking place. This shows these change requests that have taken place since the TDR. So I mentioned the single L star value, the vertical shaft, length of the main LINAC tunnels by 1.5 kilometers to fulfill a global timing constraint, and to add this margin so you can go to 550 GeV for the TT bar Higgs. There were some errors in the baseline parameters that were in the TDR, and those have been fixed, especially for the 1 TeV parameter set, and then other details, but again, this is just to give you a flavor of the level of detail that's taking place. And then there are other things that have not been completed. The thickness of the central wall, the cryogenics layout, beam delivery system, tunnel layout, and so forth. For a variety of different reasons, a group was formed by the Linear Collider Collaboration to study the operating scenarios for ILC. And this has been mentioned, I'll review it here. It's published here. It's a 500 GB scenario study with a TDR baseline plus upgrade. And it does tend to emphasize, as you'll see, it emphasizes the higher energy of the ILC as strength relative to the circular colliders. It assumes 20 years of operation. It compared many scenarios, but boiled down to three. And there's comparison with the snow mass assumptions. So the assumptions were for the operating scenario that you full calendar year is assumed to be 8 months, two-thirds of the year running at a 75% efficiency, which is the RDR assumption. That corresponds to 1.6 times 10 to the 7 seconds, which is quite a bit more than the 10 to the 7 seconds that are usually assumed. Just so you know where this comes from, the 75% efficiency came from a study done roughly 10 years ago of availability and reliability issues for the ILC. It was done by veterans of the SLC experience. Tom Himmel, Nan Finney, Mark Ross. These are heavyweight veterans from the SLC experience at SLAC, and they from their experience with the availability of the SLC, they studied what would be required to produce a 75% availability for the ILC, and this actually then fed back into the design that is in the TDR. The other assumption there, that's what justifies the 75%. The other assumption is 8 months. That might be a little unusual, but that's what we assumed. So there's a ramp up of luminosity performance assumed after initial construction and after year zero commissioning, or after a downtime for the luminosity upgrade, or a change in operational mode that may require some learning, such as going from 5 to 10 Hertz collisions. And then the ramp of 10%, 30%, 60%, 100% was assumed over the first 4 years, going this where percentage of the design luminosity is assumed to be achieved at these different stages. The ramp after the shutdowns for installation of the luminosity upgrade is assumed to be slightly shorter, 10%, 50%, 100%. After 8 years, you assume you know more about the accelerator. Going down in SunRats energy from 500 to 250 is assumed to have no ramp since there's no machine modification. But going to 10 Hertz operation at 50% gradient does assume a ramp, since the 10 Hertz affects the whole machine. For luminosity upgrade, it was assumed a 18-month shutdown would be required to install the klystrons and modulators and a third damping ring. For the luminosity upgrade, you kept the power constant at 200 megawatts, which meant you run at 10 hertz and roughly 7 hertz or 8 hertz at 350 GeV. Out of all the scenarios, there was one that was preferred that gave the greatest physics output in the shortest amount of time. And it involved a initial 8 years where you ran first at 500 GeV. There you do very useful physics studies in, with the WW fusion, and it's also felt that this would be an opportunity to search for new particles such as those with very low weak Susie particles that may have a very low visible energy after decaying to the neutrino, and that may have been missed by LHC. And so it was felt to start, since this is, it was declared to be available from the beginning, it was felt this one should take advantage of that and start at 500 GeV. Then one goes down for to 350 GeV for a year to accumulate luminosity to study the TT bar threshold. Then after 5 years, you then run at 250 GeV and accumulate 500 inverse femtobar. So this was switched around in many different ways, but this gave the best results for the Higgs in the shortest amount of time, and then also allowed you to do new particle searches at this highest energy. And so this is just a summary here of the total. Oh, I'm sorry. Then there's the luminosity upgrade. And then after that, you run at 500 GeV, accumulating 3.5 inverse attobarns. And then in 3 more years at 250 GeV, accumulating 1.5 inverse attobarns. Absolutely, yeah. This assumes that you end up only finding the Higgs. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Also, another thing was we talk about the benefit of polarization in terms of, for example, increasing the Higgs cross section, the Z Higgs cross section, and especially the nu Higgs, the WW fusion cross section, which it certainly does. However, we controlled ourselves and realized that there might be other applications where the polarization would be reversed, namely not just left-handed electrons and right-handed positrons. For example, in the at 250 GeV in the invisible Higgs decay analysis, it's beneficial to suppress backgrounds to run with right-handed electrons instead of left-handed. You lose a little bit of Higgs rate, but you gain greatly in the background reduction. And there may be studies and searches at 500 GeV where you want to run in both polarization modes. So we divided up the polarization in such a way that it wasn't always left-handed for the Higgs study, or it wasn't always right-handed for something else. It was the same assumption was made for all the different studies. So having gone through the survey of the accelerators, let me just say a few words then about the complementarity of some of the physics outputs. So Alain showed what you could do with the Terra-Z operation of the FCCEE. And so that would certainly blow away all this stuff here. But this just shows what you'd do if you had the ILC and CPC, what sort of complementarity you would have with those two machines. And so the ILC with its polarization would measure the A left right, of course, just like it did at SLC and the A sub B, whereas the other parameters would be measured very well with CPC. So there's some complementarity here. If this is your type of luminosity at the lower energies, there's still complementarity with the ILC. Yeah. Was that? That's true. I'd have to go back. Well, we're assuming now. We think we can do in situ beam energy measurements in a way that you could not do at LEP. Because of the much better momentum resolution, right? There's some thoughts along those lines, but why this is Yeah, I have to go back and see where this thing here comes from. For assume for CPC. Yeah. Right, that's right. I'd have to go back to the physics pre-CDR to answer that. I don't know. Okay, then for the Higgs, one can take the all the measurements from the ILC reports and from the pre-CDR for the CPC. So you have cross-section and sigma-time branch ratio measurements, and you can then fit for the error on the coupling, relative coupling errors, both for the two machines by themselves and for them combined. And so this shows the relative coupling errors of the two machines, assuming the five inverse Atabarns for CBC after the first 8 years of the H20 scenario for the ILC. And so, of course, because of this much higher luminosity, for almost all these couplings, you get a better better precision from the CBC. The one exception is the WW, because you run it because of this data that was taken here at higher energies. But in almost all cases, you get a decent improvement from the two of them combined, factor of two or more in some cases, especially for the B and the W. So the two, there is good complementarity here. After 20 years of running, I'm assuming that CPC goes on to 100 TeV proton collisions, then the ILC by itself will have better resolution in all cases except for two. The Z coupling is still only comes from this measurement at 250 GeV, so we still get a better result from CPC. And the same thing with the invisible width, and the invisible branching fraction is coming from a dedicated study at 250 GeV. Yes, the TT and the TT and what? Self-coupling, yes, self-coupling. Right. I've that's on a separate slide in another talk that's not included here. But yeah. Well, right. And the self-coupling, for both with TD and right TD. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Oh, you mean you're talking about the difference between 500 and 550? Right. Right, right. And so, and in a full talk on, I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, and that's okay. You'll get. Yeah, okay, fine. Then you'll get something here, but otherwise you won't get much. For here, for these very low, for these for which the LHC really shines, but for the rest, I don't know if you're going to get much. Gamma, gamma, and mu, mu, but for the rest, I don't think you're going to get. Yeah. Oh, the TTH, that has to be reviewed. Yes, I heard what you said yesterday about the TTH. That we need to look at that. Yeah, we need to look at that. For the TTH, yeah, we got to look at, yeah, we have to look at that, yeah. Yeah. Yes, they do, because that's how you really take advantage of this running at 500 GB. Well, though it's not that important. Okay, I'm sorry. Let me take that back. The hadronic decays of the Z are very important in the initial running when you don't have data from 250 GeV, assuming you only have an ILC. But once you go down to 250 GeV, then the hadronic Z decays for the measurement of the ZH cross section is not so important anymore. But for the branching rate, the signalized branching fractions, the Z decays to Higgs are used all the time. I mean, as the Z decays to hadrons are used all the time for the signalized branching ratio measurements. At 250 and 350 GeV. But for the Z Higgs cross-section measurement, it is used, but it's not so important once you've run it 250 GeV. For which? Right. Absolutely. Right. It's significantly better than, it's absolutely much, much better than lepton recoil measurement of the ZH. It's just that once you get down to, but that's if you can't go down to 250. But once you go down to 250, you can measure it fairly well with the leptonic Z decay. But you still benefit from the other measurements at 350. Yeah. And I'd imagine 350 is going to be better than 500 for that measurement because of the ZH cross section is much bigger at 350 than 500. Okay, so now let me just in my last 10 minutes. Okay, well, I'll just be fine. So just to add a little something that's different, I'll talk about some things that you may not have seen before. Right after the Higgs was discovered, we went through and studied what besides the LC linear colliders or circular colliders, are there any other ways that one can produce a Higgs factory? And then let's just look, for example, at F-channel annihilation through these particles here. So these are the partial widths, and the measurement of this process is mentioned in FCCEE Higgs studies as a means to assess the electron-Yukawa coupling, but it's certainly absolutely can't be considered a Higgs factory. Muon collider Higgs factories have been discussed that operate with delta E over E of less than 0.01% to match the Higgs width. However, there are a lot of technical challenges remain. It's interesting to note that the standard model gamma gamma partial width is 10 times the mu plus mu minus partial width. The question is there any way that you can operate a gamma gamma collider with a very small gamma-gamma center mass energy spread to take advantage of this relatively large gamma-gamma partial width? With a small total width like this, the smaller you make the gamma-gamma center mass energy spread, the greater your Higgs production rate. And it just will continue to increase because you'll never get down to that. So it's just the better your width, the more your Higgs. So photon collider basics, photons from high-powered laser are scattered off the high-energy beam electrons of a linear collider between the final quadrupole and the interaction point. The compensated scattered photons acquire the momentum of the high energy electrons and collide at the IP with the photons from the opposing beam. The gamma gamma luminosity will be given roughly by the geometric E plus mi, or E minus, E plus E minus luminosity actually will be an E minus minus luminosity, because you run with E minus minus in this case, times a Compton conversion efficiency squared. Some of the variables that are used here is an X parameter, where ME squared times X plus one is the center mass, is the center mass energy squared of the electron and the laser photon. Omega zero is the laser, laser photon energy. Omega is the Compton scattered high energy photon energy, and then you have a Compton angle of the Compton scattered photon. And in the following, I calculate expression rate while varying this X parameter, the center mass energy of the laser. That means essentially varying the laser photon energy. The signs essentially of the laser photon, the laser beam polarization, and the essentially the sign of the electron beam helicity. There are two thresholds that are important as this laser energy is varied. One is 4.82. At this value, gamma gamma to E plus E minus opens up, which then will deplete the high energy photon beam. And this effect is included in the Higgs cross section calculation, as given by the variable kappa. At x equals 8, Beta-Heitler process opens up. This process smears the electron energy and hence smears the high energy photon spectrum. In this study, the effects of that are not included. I plot the luminosity energy spectrum along with the mean helicity of the two high energy photon beams. And then there's nonlinear effects are not included here. So this is the nominal operating point of X of 4.82. With 125 GeV Higgs, you'd run at 158 GeV center mass energy in E minus. And the polar, and here I assume a polarization of 90%, which we probably should be assuming anyway for the ILC. So here I do. And kappa is, again, 1 minus the probability that a gamma annihilates with a laser gamma. The integral of the gamma gamma cross section times the this luminosity, gamma gamma luminosity is, for this case, 247 femtobarns. Cross section shown here. And here's the mean helicity. So here's where the helicity favors the Higgs production and disfavors the background, J equals 2 dB bar, for example. As you go to, as you start increasing X, your rate, your effective cross section goes down. And that's mainly because of this. More of your laser photons are annihilating high energy photon. You're losing more of your high energy photons, and that that continues. I'll just go quickly through here until you reach about X of 40. Then it starts to rise again, and it continues to rise. And by the time you get to this value here, which is now you have X, now you're colliding with X-ray laser photons. You have a hefty effect of cross section, and you can't go any further at this stage because now this you've now matched the energy spread of the electron beam. So going further is not going to gain you anything. These are laser. This is an example laser at X equals 15. X equals 15870 is an X-ray laser with just insane parameters. Assuming these can be achieved, and assuming this kind of the ILC TDR geometric luminosity for 200 GeV was valid for 126, then you get 144,000 Higgs per year, which is roughly the CPC Higgs production rate. But there's a problem that was identified by Valerie Telnoff that that this process, the gamma goes to the trident process, spreads out the electron energy. So this is starting with no electron energy spread. Then after the Beta-Heitler processes that take place, you have this kind of energy spread here. So this is going to degrade this quite a bit, degrade your effective Higgs rate quite a bit. Not included in all this is nonlinear strong field effects. In some cases, they help the they help things. In other cases, they hurt them. One has to include them to get a continue this study, and that will take place in the future. And then I'm going to end on if the 750 turns out to be real, what kind of rate going to hope to achieve at a gamma-gamma collider at 1 TeV. For that, for example, one can use, for example, X equals 2 micron laser, and that would give you an X of 4.82, and you get the same spectrum that was shown earlier. And then this shows the cross-section as a function of the E minus minus center mass energies for different assumptions about the width of the width of the 750 object with respect to its mass. And so, and the conclusion, I mean, the what you take away from this is that a few inverse Atobarns of E minus minus luminosity will give you a few hundred thousands of these events to study. The rate of E plus minus to goes to gamma plus this object is much more dependent on the properties of the particles. This is the more guaranteed method of seeing this object. And so, okay, so that's all I have to say. Yeah, it is that is one of the things that it does. As you vary the this photon energy, it does sharpen the the spectrum quite a bit. But there are other things that are taking place that are going to cause a problem. And for example, remember this you have a large fraction of the photons annihilated E plus E minus, and some other things as well. But yeah, it does sharpen the spectrum. Yeah. At with the larger X values, yeah. So I mean, especially if you have, that has to be In general, if you have a large Higgs ray, you probably have. This polarization is enhancing the Higgs and suppressing the background. That was the case at these lower X values and continues here. Yeah, but that would have to be that would have to be studied as well. So this shows values of about of the product of these two polarizations, about 98%. And for the studies that have been done, studies were done at 4.82. A similar kind of polarization. So I think the background should be about the same as it was for the earlier studies ever done at the smaller X values. Yeah. Can convince yourselves that Babas and I mean the equivalent of Babas, gamma to the you cannot convince yourself that that could be used. Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Right now the biggest problem is finding a for the Higgs production. right now the problem is finding a valid physics reason for doing it. I think that this kind of rate here just isn't going to give you much information compared to what you get in plus and minus colliders. Yeah. I mean, and if you really want to, if you're going to invest in all these studies, which start with these background studies, but that's just the beginning. The laser and the establishment that could actually be done, and all the work that would be needed, you need to first demonstrate that you have a physics program that really buys you something. And the only way to me that you could prove, you could have such a scenario is if you were producing a very, very large number of Higgses, such as the CPC or FCCE is supposed to do.